There have been great strides in preventing and treating cancer in recent decades, but still more than 6,000 Iowans are expected to die from cancer this year. This hour, the latest Cancer in Iowa report. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also today, the role of a victim's advocate in cases of murder, how Iowa's turtle population suffers from over-harvesting, why the Des Moines Waterworks Board is suing three Iowa counties, and Iowa Public Radio's Bob Doerr explores the crossroads between music and politics. Your Friday NewsBuzz starts after this news from NPR. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations on NewsBuzz about Iowa news to wrap up the week. Today sees the release of the annual Cancer in Iowa report. It's a report issued by the State Health Registry of Iowa based in the University of Iowa College of Public Health. It's a registry that's been recording the occurrence of cancer in Iowa since 1973. Joining us now to discuss this year's findings, Dr. George Wiener, director of the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of Iowa. Dr. Wiener, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Dr. Wiener, start us off by just giving us a picture of cancer in Iowa. How many people have cancer? How many new cancer patients there are this year or will be projected in this year?
We don't expect a big change year to year, and we haven't seen it this year, although there certainly are trends when we look over longer periods of time. We're estimating that there'll be 16,900 new cancer cases diagnosed in Iowa in 2015, and that sadly 6,400 Iowans will die from cancer this year.
It's interesting reading your report that number you just mentioned, cancer deaths in Iowa, 6,400 expected to die this year. That's 18 times the number killed by traffic accidents.
It's absolutely true. People get a little numbed by the statistics, and particularly when you think that each one of those individuals, obviously the disease affects loved ones and the economy of the state, it truly is a huge burden for the people of Iowa.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the most common forms of cancer for men and for women that you see in the stats in these reports?
Well, there are two different pieces of information we tend to look at. We look at the incidence of cancer, and then we look at death from cancer. And if we actually look at, you know, the more important of those, which is deaths from cancer, far and away the top cancer killer continues to be lung cancer, and that's for both men and women. Part of the reason is that lung cancer tends to be harder to catch earlier, and therefore a larger percentage of patients actually end up dying of that disease. If you look at the most common cancers in women, it would be breast cancer, and in men, it's prostate cancer.
Mm-hmm. What sort of trends are you seeing in this latest report?
Well, we see a few trends as we look over time. Even though the total number of cancer deaths is not changing much, we're actually seeing a reduction in age-adjusted cancer deaths. So cancer is more common in elderly people. And, in fact, even though our treatments are getting better, our approaches to early detection are getting better, people are living longer. And then people are living longer long enough to get cancer who actually previously would have died of some other disease.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what cancers we've had most success in treating over the recent years?
Well, we've had a huge amount of success treating pediatric leukemia, where 15, 20 years ago, a child with acute leukemia was basically a death sentence. Now, depending upon the subtype, we can cure 80, 90, or even more percent of patients with childhood leukemia. We've had a lot of success in treatment of Hodgkin lymphoma and other forms of lymphoma as well. Testicular cancer, which used to be 100% fatal, is now highly curable. So we've had success in treating a number of areas. There are other areas where prevention and early detection are playing a major role. Certainly, I mentioned lung cancer already. We know what causes the vast majority of cases of lung cancer, and that's tobacco use. We also know in Iowa that non-smokers can get lung cancer, and that the risk of non-smokers getting lung cancer is increased in people who have been exposed to radon.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're working very hard now to mitigate that radon exposure with hopes that 5-10 years from now, we'll see a dramatic drop in the incidence of lung cancer in non-smokers.
Now, some movement in the Iowa legislature on that point of radon gas, and we need to remind ourselves that those who don't know it need to know that Iowa leads the nation in the presence of radon, this cancer-causing radioactive gas. Our high percentage of our homes have levels that are above the Environmental Protection Agency's recommended levels. And it seems that bills in both chambers of our legislature having to do with radon testing survived last week's funnel. I don't know how much you're paying attention to that going on in the legislature. That must be encouraging.
Oh, it's very encouraging, and we've been working on this issue for a number of years. In addition to my job at the university, I'm also president of the Iowa Cancer Consortium, which is a statewide organization interested in reducing the burden of cancer. And radon has been of high priority for our consortium.
Mm-hmm.
Radon, as you said, is a naturally occurring gas that seeps into houses through the basement. And in fact, I first learned of radon about 4 or 5 years ago, had my house tested, the levels were high, and we went and had it mitigated. It was a very simple process. We put a small fan in the basement and sealed up the sump pump area, and that's dramatically dropped the amount of radon in my home.
Yeah, ditto on that for me, Dr. Wiener. We discovered that a number of years ago in our house in the basement, and we had children's bedrooms in the basement. And that's especially important, and as you said, a pretty quick fix. I think it was $1,000 or $1,200 to get a mitigation system, a one-time cost if it keeps operating.
Yes, it was $800 for us, and it's been working fine now since then. One of the things we're looking at in the legislature is encouraging schools to get tested. We do believe that exposure during childhood and long exposure to radon is what can cause problems, and certainly making sure our schools are as safe as possible would seem to be pretty straightforward concept.
What is the law now? You mean Iowa schools are not tested? There is no mandatory testing?
There's no mandatory testing right now. Many have done it voluntarily, but we feel that it's important that it is mandatory and that it should be abated if high radon is found.
Okay. Those bills, we'll watch those bills in both chambers of the Iowa legislature. Of course, it costs money, and that's something that education is short of these days. So that's, of course, a competing interest there. Also mentioned before you go, I want to have you mention another aspect of this latest Iowa cancer report, skin cancer. There's a worrying trend there.
There is. So skin cancer comes in a number of forms. The most deadly is melanoma skin cancer. And melanoma skin cancer incidence is directly related to skin damage that can be caused by natural sunlight or by indoor tanning. And we are actually seeing an epidemic of melanoma skin cancer, particularly in young women and girls who do artificial tanning.
Epidemic, can you give any numbers to that? How much has it increased in Iowa?
Well, in fact, even older men more commonly get melanoma skin cancers, but in girls who tan versus those who don't, melanoma skin cancer is 70 times more common.
Hmm.
So the chance of a young woman who doesn't tan and uses sunblock, et cetera, of actually getting melanoma when they're younger is extremely small. However, those who tan markedly increase the risk of that happening.
Turning back to a bill before the Iowa legislature, a different one, I imagine you support a bill that would ban indoor tanning for teens.
I do.
Mm-hmm. Clarify that, because it's not clear. Of course, that's not the sun you're getting from an indoor tanning booth. Are those rays that tan you indoors any safer, or could they ever be completely safe?
No, they really couldn't. The reason the skin tans is because damage has been done. It's actually a response to the damage in the skin, with the body trying to protect itself from future damage. So there really is no safe way to get a tan. It really is a reflection of our body responding to the radiation that comes from the light.
Mm-hmm. Dr. George Wiener of the University of Iowa Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center. Before you go, I wonder if you can sum up in a minute or so. When I think back at my childhood, first exposure to the word, very scary word, cancer, and this disease was in elementary school, and we would collect money to send mice to college for cancer or research. That's many decades ago. I don't know if that's in your childhood as well, but what can you say about the war on cancer in the intervening decades?
Well, I'd start out by saying we are making progress, that we are better, we understand the causes of cancer. We're able to work with society in general to implement safer practices to reduce the incidence of cancer. We're better at screening for early stage cancers to catch them early. And we've made significant progress for some cancers in cancer treatment. So we are making progress. We've learned that cancer is much more complex than we ever imagined. And the idea of us finding a single magic bullet that will be a cure for cancer, we now know that cancer is actually hundreds of different diseases and not one. With that understanding, we're at a time now that's more exciting than ever related to cancer research. At the same time, the government is cutting back on support for cancer research. So it's sort of the best of times, the worst of times. It's the best of times because of all the progress we've made and our ability to use that knowledge to reduce the burden of cancer. It's the worst of times because we haven't made more progress and our ability to accelerate progress is being slowed by a lack of resources. So we need those kids to keep sending their nickels and dimes in so that we can continue to accelerate progress and people to talk to their legislative leaders about the importance of cancer research.
Okay. Very good. Dr. George Wiener, director of the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of Iowa. Thank you for talking to us about cancer and about the latest annual Cancer in Iowa report. Dr. Wiener, thank you.
My pleasure.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thank you for joining us this Friday. Many will remember the tragic case of 5-year-old Evelyn Miller. Evelyn went missing in the summer of 2005. Her body was found in the Cedar River 5 days after she was reported missing. This week, nearly 10 years after the crime, a jury convicted a man of first-degree murder and sexual assault in the killing. After 5 hours of deliberation, jurors found 35-year-old Casey Fredrickson guilty of sexually abusing Evelyn Miller and stabbing her to death while babysitting her in July of 2005. A sentencing hearing is scheduled for May 11th. Fredrickson faces life in prison without parole. B.J. Franklin joins me now by phone. She's director of the Horizons Survivors Program, a victims advocate program. B.J. Franklin, welcome to the program.
Hello, Ben.
Hi. You are a victims advocate and have worked closely with this family and extended family since the very beginning, since right after little Evelyn went missing in 2005. I know there's some things that you can't talk about due to confidentiality rules, but can you give us a sense of your feelings, your thoughts, the feelings of a victim's family after such a long, painful ordeal when this guilty verdict is finally read?
You know, I don't think that you can totally describe the feelings that families have when they get a guilty verdict after such a long period of waiting. I think that it's very difficult for families in general to grieve the murder of any loved one. When you capitalize that with a violent murder of a small child coupled with violent sexual assault, when you finally get that verdict, I think that most families are going to, be incredibly relieved and exalted. And then there's going to be, the time after that initial feeling of relief where now they really have to begin grieving the loss of their loved one.
Mm-hmm. Tell us when you entered the picture in this tragic case, BJ.
The Survivors Program was contacted initially when Evelyn was just missing by the Division of Criminal Investigation. So they requested us to come and assist because there were so many agencies and individuals involved in this case initially. They had over 300 people searching for Evelyn. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children were involved. The FBI was involved. The DCI was involved. Floyd County Sheriff's Department was active. There were other area law enforcement agencies that were very active in working this case and searching for Evelyn. So, I mean, I think there was just kind of a need for somebody to be able to kind of focus on the needs of the family and to make sure that the family was being communicated with, you know, each step of the way.
Mm-hmm. Some might not know. Go into a little bit of more detail. What does a victim advocate do in this case or other cases when a violent crime has been committed?
Well, you know, I think that each program's a little bit differently. At the time when Evelyn was killed, we were pretty much the only homicide program that was working in the eastern part of the state of Iowa. And so, you know, at that time we were able to, we actually go and respond immediately to where the case is occurring so that we can assist the family, like I said, with, you know, so that they have somebody that's looking out for their rights. You have a right under the Code of Iowa to a victim advocate. You know, people don't understand that sometimes, that they actually have a legal right to have an advocate present for them. And when a violent crime has occurred. And so we can go and we can work with law enforcement, we can work with prosecution offices. The Attorney General's office was, you know, active in this case for a number of years. The DCI, like I said, requested our presence. So we can go and, you know, help the family file for victim compensation. We can help the family, you know, get their questions asked, you know, to the best of our ability in regards to what's happening with the case. We can assist them with the media. Our goal, you know, it changes over time. We're the only advocacy program, homicide advocacy programs in general, stay involved with families through the investigation, prosecution, and post-sentencing. So just because now that the case is done through the court system doesn't mean that we are done offering services to families.
You mentioned the media there, of course, at the beginning of this, the search for Evelyn at the beginning, and then the discovery of the body. The media was well engaged there. What are some of the challenges you face as a victim's advocate, being, I guess, between the family and the media, or advising the family about the media, also advising the media about what it's like to be part of a traumatized family?
You know, I think that the media is in a difficult spot, and obviously I think that the family is an incredibly difficult spot. What I try to explain to people is try to think of your most vulnerable time in your life and think about what that would be like if somebody put a camera in your face at that moment and asked you to describe what you were feeling. You know, that's incredibly difficult to do, and, you know, I think that, you know, I've had other cases, you know, where there have been child deaths or whatever, and the public wants to know that the family is doing okay, or they want to know, you know, how is the family handling this horrific situation? Because, you know, a lot of people look at what these families are going through, and it's like, oh my gosh, I don't know how I would ever be able to deal with that. And so there's a lot of genuine concern from the public in regards to, you know, how do you deal with something like that? Are they okay? And, you know, but the family is just feeling very exposed. And so it's that hard balance that the media has in regards to trying to get out information and the family and respecting the family's privacy at the same time.
Do you think that all journalists, whether they're television or newspaper or radio, are well aware of what is needed when you approach a traumatized family?
Personally, I do not. I think that, you know, there's a quote that I like to use that says, you know, if you're going to cover baseball, know about baseball. You know, if you're going to cover trauma, then you better have some kind of understanding about trauma.
Mm-hmm. The trial has been going on, and yet now we have the guilty verdict. What kind of challenges do you face as a victim's advocate when it comes to the trial period? Do all family members want to be present at the trial, or is that very individual in a decision?
That's very individual within a family. I always say that, you know, families don't grieve, individuals and families grieve, and how they choose to grieve is going to be very unique to them and their relationship with the person that they lost, and also just in regards to what they feel they need. You know, some people absolutely want to be involved in every moment. They want to, you know, have that information. And other family members, they just really don't. And they want to just preserve the memory that they have of their person without information that comes with how they died.
For those who do want to be present during the trial and the reading of the verdict, what are the family members looking for who are attending the trial of someone accused of killing a loved one of theirs?
I think that that's really unique, too, but I think that most family members that I talk with, you know, want some kind of understanding, or they want information in regards to sort of what their loved one experienced toward the end, possibly. And so there's lots of questions, and a lot of those questions never get answered through the court system.
Mm-hmm.
But for the questions that can be answered through that process, that's what family is looking for.
Mm-hmm. The trial is over in this case. A guilty verdict has been handed down by the jury. It didn't take them very long to do that. Casey Fredrickson facing life behind bars. His sentencing is to come. What about the family at this point? In what sense does a guilty verdict like this allow a family closure? And what does closure mean?
I don't think that there is such a thing as closure, because you can't ever bring back the person. I think that the family, I think that this is one section of the journey that the family is able to say, okay, I've completed the trial, and now I need to move on to this next part of the journey. I don't think that they ever arrive at a spot where they can say, okay, now I'm done.
Mm-hmm. What is typically, in your experience, having handled many of these cases, what is the next part of the journey?
I think that the next part of the journey for most family members is actually being able to revisit their grief for their loved one. Because when you're, you know, take a case that has gone on for 10 years, or take a case that's gone on for 5 years, you know, your focus sporadically throughout this time is on the court system. What's the next step in the court system? What's the next thing that's, you know, what's the next hearing? What's the next motion? What's the next piece of evidence that's going to get tossed out? What's, you know, and so actually being able to just stop and say, this is what I lost, that a lot of times for family members does not incur until after the verdict.
Mm-hmm. We have a few seconds left. Some may be curious, having first heard of a victim's advocate or a Horizon Survivors program. How are you funded?
We're funded through the Victims of Crime Act, through the state. And there's one thing, Ben, I just really want to say before we get done. Family members, you know, this case was 10 years in the making. There was not victim compensation for travel at that time. And so, and food is never covered for family members. And so this family member, we really had to collaborate with other agencies to provide this family with food and okay, hotel and those types of things.
Okay, we have to go, B.J. Franklin. I want to thank you for giving us insights into your work, your valuable work as director of the Horizons Survivors Program and as a victim's advocate. Thank you, B.J.
All right. Thanks, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, how Iowa's turtle population is suffering from over-harvesting and why the Des Moines Water Works Board is suing three Iowa counties. Back with more of Iowa Public Radio's News Buzz in just a moment. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition on this Friday. Fridays, we like to wrap up the week with a number of quick conversations about news items we didn't get to otherwise during our talk shows. Still to come a little bit later, I'll talk with Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters about why the Des Moines Water Works Board is suing three Iowa counties. Also, Iowa Public Radio's Bob Doerr joins me at the end of the program. He'll explore an idea that explores the crossroads of music and politics. But first, state officials are reporting an increase in the harvest of wild turtles in Iowa, and because of that, are proposing new limits for their capture. Currently, there are no limits placed on turtle harvest in this state. Iowa is one of 10 states without limits on its turtle harvest season. All of our surrounding Midwest states, as a matter of fact, except our neighbor to the south, Missouri, prohibit or limit turtle harvesting. We do not here in Iowa. Joining me to talk about that, Martin Conrad is with us, fisheries biologist for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Hello, Martin.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You know, they're so reclusive and shy, these creatures. Tell us, how many of them are here in Iowa?
Well, that's a good question, Ben. And many of the public believes that the natural resource agencies actually manage wildlife populations known based on numbers, but that's not true. We monitor by trends what we see in survey information, and the survey information that we have and literature research has been done in neighboring states and around the nation indicates that our turtle populations are being overexploited, and we need to take action now before we actually see a decline in those numbers.
Mm-hmm. So people listening, if they're used to seeing turtles in past decades and they're wondering, where did they go? Why aren't they on the riverbanks or sunning themselves on logs or rocks along our waterways? That's not just their imagination. There is a drop in the population.
We hear that from people, especially like the canoe and kayak or rivers. And when we the DNR started to propose a harvest season, many of our public comments that were in favor of this proposal, it was just saying that we have not been seeing turtles in the past, and maybe it's an awareness of our proposal, and maybe that's why. And you know, they're not seeing those mm-hmm. in the numbers that they have in the past.
What do you at the DNR think is driving the decreasing populations?
Well, there's a number of things. We believe that from our information with turtle harvesters and buyers that some of these harvester turtles are going for meat, but they're also going to an Asian market, and it's a high demand. An international study of exported turtles has shown that from 1997, there is approximately 3.5 million turtles exported, and by 2000, that reached 13.7 million, and from 2002 through 2012, 127 million turtles have been exported out of the U.S., and most of these turtles, I got to admit, are from farm-raised turtles, but most of those farm-raised turtles, as far as when we talk about snapping turtles or soft shells, that brood source is from a wild stock. Here in Iowa, our turtle farmers cannot use those turtles harvested in Iowa, but they can be exported to neighboring states that allow commercial aquaculture turtles.
Mm-hmm. This is really an eye-opener, Martin, because most of us, I would think, do not eat turtles. So there are turtle harvesters and buyers. A number of our turtles, who knows how many, end up on Asian dinner tables. How much is a turtle worth, you know, per pound?
Live weight, when the harvester sells to a buyer, we hear it's $1.50. And also we've heard since females are in higher demand, they can go as high as $4 a pound, which tells us that there are not being used for the food market, but probably are being exported out of state for turtle farming. Mm-hmm. And then we had one turtle buyer that actually exports his turtles to Louisiana for food processing. And based on the market, he may get anywhere from $12 to $16 a pound dressed.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, for fish in Iowa, for deer, for pheasant, for other animals that are hunted, you have to buy a license to be law-abiding. Do you need to do that for turtles?
You do for commercial harvest of turtles. That's a $100 license to harvest, and you also have to have a buyer's permit. We also allow sport harvest, and as long as an individual has a valid fishing license, they're permitted to take a maximum of 100 pounds of live turtles or 50 pounds of dressed turtles. But the commercial harvester is unlimited on how many turtles they can harvest.
Martin Conrad, as a fisheries biologist, very acquainted with the life cycle of the turtles and the various species of turtles we have here in Iowa, considering we have this over-harvesting apparently, what do you think at the DNR would be a remedy here? We are an outlier, as I mentioned at the beginning, a state without limits on the turtle harvest season.
What the department believes is the first step is to establish a July 16th through December 31st harvest season for turtles. And all other months' dates are closed. And particularly what we are wanting is to give the chance for the turtles to breed and for females to nest. So we want to protect those females to give them allow them a chance to lay their eggs and until they have a chance of being harvested. And this is pretty important because of the life characteristic of turtles. They're very long-lived. And being long-lived, they don't mature usually until age 8, and they may only lay as a maximum number of 50 eggs for a large snapping turtles. And then the predation on those nests are very high, as well as the predation on the little turtles. So very few little turtles reach adult size. But once they do reach adult size, their chance of survival, if not taken by human, is very high. And that gives them the ability to lay multiple times, multiple years. So there is a chance for recruitment of small turtles to adult size.
Okay. Very informative, insightful. Martin Conrad, fisheries biologist for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Thank you for telling us about turtles.
You're welcome.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tuesday of this week, the Des Moines Water Works Board voted to sue three northwest Iowa counties over high nitrate levels in the Des Moines and Raccoon Rivers. These two rivers supply the city of Des Moines with drinking water. The chair of the board says that unless nitrate levels are reduced in these rivers, the city will have to spend between $80 and $100 million on a new denitrification unit. Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters has been covering this story. Joins me now. Hello, Clay.
Hey, Ben.
So the Des Moines Water Works first announced its intent to sue way back in January. They've been waiting, I don't know, waiting for what? Was this expected to go through with it?
Well, as you say, this has been something that's been building for quite a while now. The Des Moines Water Works has to clean the water from the Raccoon and Des Moines rivers. At its very basic level, it's pretty polluted. They've had these significant peaks in nitrate concentrations over the last couple years. Its costly denitrification system they have to use goes back to the ratepayers, those people that when they get their water bills, they're feeling it on that end. So there's violations of the Clean Water Act. Now, you say back in January, yes, the board said, yes, it is our intent to sue. When Bill Stowe, the CEO and general manager of the Des Moines Water Works, was on Morning Edition the morning after they had voted to have this intent to sue, he was saying that he was hoping agriculture groups would step forward with what the Des Moines Water Works CEO called principled answers to take care of this problem. As he sees it, they did not. In fact, it ruffled a lot of feathers, as a lot of lawsuits do. Big ag groups were really quick to call the lawsuit sensationalistic and dishonest. The Des Moines Water Works would say, okay, well, the testing from their labs shows that Sac County has proven that it is not sensationalistic and dishonest, that there is a problem, that they are obviously now going to pull the trigger on this lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. Just to make sure we understand that all three of these counties, Sac, Buena Vista, and Calhoun counties, they are in the northwest part of the state, and they have riverways, waterways that feed into the Des Moines and Raccoon rivers, Des Moines has to draw some of its drinking water out of that. This is an unusual move, isn't it, Clay, for a municipal water utility to sue a county board? Would
this set a precedent for other environmental lawsuits and gain some has some interest actually from outside Iowa, doesn't it?
Very much so. The rest of the nation is really watching. Big agriculture groups are keeping a close eye on this, as are many environmental groups, to see what moves forward this. And, I mean, think about it. More than 2 million acres, mostly farmland, drain into the Raccoon River. The Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy from a few years back was this collaboration announced from the Iowa DNR and the Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, as well as Iowa State University. And they're all coming together and saying, yes, there is a problem. There's nobody here that's saying there is not a problem with water quality. And some even see this Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy as a progressive strategy to help farmers improve water quality. I got some figures from the Department of Agriculture before I came on here. They're saying that 1,600 farmers have invested $4.2 million to try a new practice on their farm to better protect water over the past 2 years, and that the state has even provided $7.4 million in funding to support projects, leveraged $11.7 million in additional funding from partners and landowners. Now, these practices that we're talking about, they run the gamut from planting cover crops to buffer strips to how much fertilizer is used. And there is some kind of misleading information sometimes as we try to glaze over what's going on here, that it's largely from fertilizer running into streams. I talked with an agronomist with Practical Farmers just yesterday, saying that, you know, changing nitrogen fertilizer practices only improves water quality 6% compared to growing these winter plants like cover crops, a 30% improvement, or small grains, 42% improvement. What that means is during we think of fall time as harvest time and springtime as planting, but you can tell a farmer is doing more cover crops, planting these crops throughout the fall and winter so that the roots are there, keeping more of the nitrates, the nutrients, from going into the water. So it's not just fertilizer. That's one thing that kind of gets glazed over as we talk about this.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so going forward, what's the timeline that you're looking at as this story continues to unfold with the Des Moines Water Works Board voting to sue these three Northwest Iowa counties? What happens now?
Well, now we wait and see. I mean, people will be really keeping a close eye on this as it moves through the courts. I'm not really sure of what the timeline's going to be, but, you know, the weather is changing. It's feeling a lot nicer. And in Iowa, when the weather starts feeling this way, we start thinking about farmers moving into the fields and planting. So I've set up a lot of sources that are farmers in this area who are heading to the fields, and I'm going to be talking with them in the months to come about the practices that they're implementing to improve Iowa's water quality.
Okay, Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters talking about a lawsuit launched this week, the Des Moines Water Works Board voting to sue three Northwest Iowa counties over high nitrate levels, a lawsuit that has a potential to set a precedent also for agriculture outside of Iowa. Clay Masters, thanks again.
Thanks for inviting me on, Ben.
And finally, on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, we want to check in with Bob Doerr, Iowa Blues Hall of Famer and host of Iowa Public Radio's Backtracks and Blue Avenues programs. I'm a fan of both of those programs. I hope you are, too. Well, did you know that Bob Doerr is adding politics, yes, politics, to his repertoire, at least for a special edition of Backtracks coming up in April? Bob Doerr joins me now by phone. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Ben. How are you, man?
I'm doing fine. Say it ain't so. Bob Doerr getting into politics?
Well, no, this isn't exactly a politics. Actually, it's kind of anti-politics.
Okay.
But it deals with politicians, which is kind of a stretch, I suppose. But the idea that actually this thing has just taken off to be far greater than I ever expected it to be.
Mm-hmm. What is going on? What's the idea for the show?
So here's the deal. I'm a public person, so I wind up friending just about anybody who requests to be my friend on Facebook. And some of my I know some people, and I don't know some people. And recently, on the monthly live listener pick shows, I've posted on my Facebook page that we're going to be doing this, and I take advance requests or suggestions on my Facebook page. And when I find the record or the disc or the cassette or the 8-track where the song is, then I kind of post on that thread if I found it and when it's going to be played and stuff like that. So there was this fellow named Scott Orth, and I posted that I was going to play one of his two suggestions. I always give people two suggestions because I don't do any downloads. I actually have to find the physical record and all of that. So I played one of these songs that was suggested by Scott Orth, and he replied that he would be listening and thanks for playing it. And, oh, by the way, I'm a state representative from Warren County.
Cool.
And come to find out, there's, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 state representatives who are Facebook friends of mine who listen to the program. And so Scott, or Representative Orth, I suppose, would be the way I'm supposed to address him. Anyway, he said, there's quite a few of our colleagues that listen to your show. And so first I'm knocked out by that prospect, and just kind of jokingly I said, well, you know, we should do an hour of backtracks picked out by state representatives. And Representative Orth has run with this thing. Joyce Russell, the IPR State House reporter, somehow found out about it. She's good, isn't she?
Oh, she's tremendous. We talked to her a lot on this program.
Well, she somehow found out about this, and it's kind of snowballed to the fact where I'm going to make Representative Orth the co-producer of the show, because he is running with this thing. He's going to put out the word to all 100 representatives and collect some of the song suggestions.
Is he going to make a speech on the floor of the House?
Said that he was going to mention it to his colleagues. Whether there's going to be an actual speech on the floor of the House, I don't know. But he really has taken the lead on all of this. So I'm just going to be the engineer, and he's going to forward me all the suggestions, and I'm going to try to do them. Now, I had planned the middle hour of backtracks on April 11th, so 3 to 4 o'clock, but you know, I only play maybe 25 or 30 songs an hour, and if there's 100 representatives and they all participate, certainly we'll spill over into the second hour. Yeah. If there's so many, I'll just do the whole show on legislator listener picks.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, Representative Orth, what kind of music does he like? Does he like to request?
Actually, the two songs that he requested this last time were really hip. Little Feat song and an Eric Clapton song from 1974, I think, 461 Ocean Boulevard was from. So these guys are pretty hip.
We'll get one of those queued up for the way out, but I want to talk to you a little bit more before we do, while we get one of those, either the Little Feat or the Eric Clapton queued up. Tell me, does this kind of lead you into thinking about, it leads me into thinking about, well, do politics say, does a person's love of a certain type of music say anything about their politics? You could team up with a political scientist and make a groundbreaking study here, Bob.
Wouldn't that be something? No, I think there actually has been studies, and I personally believe, you know, my entire life has been music, 40 years on public radio, and you can begin to get a sense of what the person is all about simply by the records in their collection.
For instance?
People that are interested in kind of middle of the road things are not quite as should we say
adventurous in their politics,
aggressive.
Okay.
As someone who would listen to Slipknot.
Okay.
You know, there are definite personalities that are attached to that. I have a speech degree, so I have no real training in being able to figure this out. But I go to people's houses, I look at their records, and I go, yeah, from what I know about you, yeah, I totally get it. So I'm very, very interested in this. I hope people aren't taking it so seriously that, oh, we have to judge our representatives by the music they like. But I think it's really kind of fun that so many of them seem to be running with this idea.
Okay, Bob Doerr, should we hear the Little Feet or the Eric Clapton on the way out? We've got both of them here. Which one?
I like the Feet myself.
Okay, let's do Little Feet. Mercenary Territory by Little Feet, requested by Representative Scott Orth. And just to remind you, Bob Doerr's special programming of Backtracks, politicians, lawmakers, request coming up April 11th. So all you lawmakers listening to this program want to get your requests into Bob Doerr at Iowa Public Radio.
And remember, I've run my show for 35 years on the advice of my friend Raz, who told me one time, don't play nothing stupid.
The Backtracks Saturdays.
Although I kind of veered from that advice occasionally.
Thanks, Bob. Backtracks Saturdays at 2 o'clock, right after my show, my music show, Java Blend.
We make quite the team.
We do. Bob Doerr, thanks for being on this show today.
Thank you, Ben.
Okay, let's listen to a little bit of Little Feet on the way out. This is Mercenary Territory. A live record, I think, is the information that I have here. River to River, produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. John Pemble helped us out in Des Moines. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Also, thanks to Julie Englander. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.